I believe that's us live now, despite the fact that we're being said it's late. It's only 2 minutes. Your time's not worth that much. Don't get too ahead of yourself. Wind your neck in. Anyway, I'm here today with Caleb Brown to talk about Hoppe's essay/talk from a number of years ago called What Must Be Done.
Yep. This would be fine.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a nice little snappy thing that involves a lot of his sort of theories on a grander scale put into a nice little sort of generalisation. So I thought we'll maybe kind of pick through some bits, try and contextualise ourselves a little bit with the first part of it. But I'd like to, I don't know, maybe just extend the logic a little, which might become quite obvious when we see with relation to the titles from. I'll need to do the usual stuff of saying thank you for the people that show up to the streams and whatever else, and those who subscribe and what have you. There is also the Streamlabs thing. Grill me in the chat for using Streamlabs. I don't know. I mean, I've obviously read, as I say, obviously, I mean, people will know from the Democratization series that we've used bits and pieces of Hoppe, and I don't know, I've talked about it to other people elsewhere. What's your relation to Hoppe's kind of writing? What kind of bits have you come across?
I've done an entire month on my podcast, why did the Hoppe months, why I went through every book of his except the new one, Economy, Society, and History, whatever it is, and Ethics of Private Property.
Yeah.
So I would always work except for those two.
I think you might have done. I think I've probably done just about the same, minus a few that are a bit difficult to get in Britain. I've found the Great Fiction pretty much has a collection of everything he's written that isn't specifically very singular economic issues, which is quite nice.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I think the best thing he ever put out was this. It's National Production and Defense, I think is what it's called. The Myth of National Defense.
Mm.
And it's not even all his writing. It's a compilation of other people's writings as well.
It's got a bit of Gustave de Molinari and stuff like that in it, doesn't it?
I think so. Personally, that one, I think Guido Huysmans' Success in Defense and Eric von Kudert-Ledin's Monarchy in War are the absolute best stuff in there. That's not a Hoppe's work, but it says Hoppe wrote it, but it's a compilation of essays, but it's probably one of the best, you know, books under Hoppe's titles, under Hoppe's list of books, you know?
Hmm. I suppose we should probably start cracking on with it then.
Let's do it.
Sound stuff there. Yeah, he starts off saying, you know, a slightly more appropriate title, and then there's a direct reference to Vladimir Lenin's 1902 book, the classic What Is to Be Done, or What Must Be Done, which I may at some point have a look at going over as a connection to this, because hopefully from this sort of guess alone, this little bit here, you should see if you've ever seen the previous stuff I've done that kind of referenced a bit of this, where I'm taking this, really. A slightly more appropriate title would be Society, State and Liberty, the Austro-Libertarian Strategy of Social Revolution. So I want to step things up a little bit after all these moderate talks that you've heard before. I want to end with some rather concrete strategic advice, but in order to give the first, I have to diagnose what the problem is. Otherwise, the cure might be worse than the disease, and the diagnosis involves some sort of systematic reconstruction or theoretical explanation of human history. I mean, I kind of just want to start with like some of the stuff we can get out of Austrian economics that maybe isn't directly obvious to certain people. I don't know. And, you know, one of the main cruxes of it is the approach to value, in the sense, you know, there is no objective value that can actually be measured. It's purely just subjective, and it's ultimately using some sort of medium like money that we can, you know, display our subjective want, at least in some sort of medium, for one another's goods or whatever. But from this, I can see that there is truly things like culture and cultural aspects of a society surely can be valued in a similar sort of way. And that we can start to kind of look a bit, we can look at sort of relationships between the structure of society and the culture it produces as being sort of one whole kind of economic system to look at. I mean, this is kind
Absolutely.
of, it seems to me like this is kind of what the some of the elite theorists are looking at, but not from the same lens. And it's kind of funny that Pareto, of all people, who was an economist, is, you know, one of the sort of forefathers of this whole kind of thing.
It's economics. A lot of people think I can. My I promise. A lot of people I think economics, and the thing I just talk about like money and trade and stuff. And it's like no, it's a way of looking at a lot of things. The Misesian praxeology can be applied to looking at a lot of what things, and you can determine values of a lot of things through and sentence structures, people's actions. It's more than just trade and GDP. Austrian economics can be applied in a lot of ways, and it's a crucial part of anyone's philosophy should include a good human understanding of human action, which is why I think Austrian economics is a. I mean, personally, me, I'm a Catholic, so my philosophies are Austrian economics and a Thomism, and so that's my way of looking at the world. And there's a lot that you can get out of Austrian economics besides just trade and GDP, you know?
No, but it's from that slightly more general view of value where you can begin to see the political or societal sort of relevance for low and high time preference. You know, if you are a low time preference individual, it could be argued that you are willing to look aside economic profit so that cultural institutions or things that your culture produce in some way, shape, or form actually sustain, as opposed to, you know, implementing some development that then, for one reason or another, causes a revolution in the mass and scale, and you no longer live in a sort of, you know, populations are so much more dense, and then you have all the misfortunes and social ills of living in cities. Anyway, we shall continue. Let me begin with a few words about society. Why is there society? Why do people cooperate? Why is there peaceful cooperation rather than permanent war among mankind? Austrians, and in particular Misesians, emphasize the fact that we do not need to assume anything like sympathy or love for the other people in order to explain this. Self-interest, that is, to prefer more over less, is entirely sufficient to explain this phenomenon of cooperations. Men cooperate because they are able to recognize that production under division of labor is more productive than self-sufficient isolation, which is kind of like an interesting point again, where he's almost blending with. You know, I think it's Robert McKells and someone else that write almost purely about just the nature of human organisation, and it's just such a key fact to economics that you must recognise that for society to produce anything that's greater than the sum of its parts, there must be some men that work under the, you know, the leadership of other men, because that is in a sense a division of labour.
No, absolutely. That's it's one of the reasons why leftist egalitarians don't work, because they have to have hierarchy. You have to have people coming together, working together to create things, and to people to work together. It has to. Well, I think it was Foucault who said any interaction between two people is going to have a dominant and a, I guess you could say, a submissive person. But it's going to be natural hierarchies that emerge, and that's how things will grow and move forward. You have to have not just how what he put. I think he put it here about Hobbes thing about. I'm trying to read it from the stream, and so I'm trying to like pause the stream and read it from here.
I was going to say the link for the PDF is in the description. It's up on the Mises website.
Oh, even better.
Let me
let me
grab
just
that and
hop
stick it in the chat.
Just grab it. Here it is. There we go. Okay, I'm trying to find a point. I wanted to highlight it, but I forgot to like take my notes with me. So let me just find it real quick. Thomas Hobbes assumed that people would be permanently isolated to this. Yeah. The Hobbes of the people are always going to be state of nature with this conflict is ridiculous. It's like it really is. It kind of my head a little bit, but it's a ridiculous idea, and it only come together through self-interest of I mean, I'm trying to sum up what Hobbes has said, but he summed it up so well, I can't really sum it up any better.
I do love, there's a really nice point in Filmer when he's talking to, he's writing to Hobbes in period. And he's like, the state of nature. When was there ever a state of nature? Just sort of like very blatantly asking him, like, can you point to where this this war of all against all ever actually existed. I don't know, I think Hopper's sort of getting at the same kind of thing here. He's sort of taking quite a. He's taking a more pessimistic view of man in a certain sense, because he's not wanting to appeal to virtue, he just wants to appeal to the kind of almost brutal logic of it.
Absolutely. No, I know that I one of the problem I was reading Hopper for the podcast, my podcast in the book club. You would try to summarize or add, and it's like he did it so well. All you can really do is commentate about how great it is, because
Well, no,
he does it
it's
so
nice to
well.
see where it ties in other stuff, and where you can see the places where he gets some of his sort of inspiration from. I mean,
Absolutely.
he goes on here. Now you notice immediately what kind of curious construction this is. People are assumed to be bad wolves, and they can be turned into sheep if another third wolf is made to rule above them. If this third party is also wolf, as obviously he must be, then even if he can make peace between two individuals, this obviously implies that there would be a permanent war between the ruling wolf and the two wolves that are now peacefully cooperating with each other, which is almost kind of like a child's version of explaining to people the Marxist view of the state as this sort of permanent vector for some kind of war of one group against another. And he's just breaking it right down into the, like, well, you've got three people, so now we'll have three people be the example.
It's a great piece.
What this implies is something of great importance. There must be no state, or there must be no independent third party in order to have cooperation between two individuals, which you can now recognise immediately if you just look, for instance, at the international scenery. There exists no such thing as a world government, at least not yet. And still, people of different countries still cooperate peacefully with each other, or even out of the greatest social chaos, cooperation always emerges again. Pardon me. Sorry about that. But
All good.
that's caught me off guard there for a second. But no, there's a sort of continuation of this idea that, there must be some semblance of order for there then to be, any kind of liberty or any kind of recognition of, the specific language of cooperation as opposed to just working together under some kind of order. I think there's a sort of point here is getting to where you can almost begin to make a similar point about sort of sovereignty, and that people in a sort of previous order where they weren't so owned by the state in the way that they are now genuinely had reasons to cooperate. And now that the state, allows you to absolve yourself of so much of the responsibility you would only be able to grant from people who you actually had good favour with and they had a reason to help you. But now that that's all dissolved between people, there's no cooperation, there's just a sort of like mealy, shallow competitiveness that people have with one another. And it's a relation almost to that kind of time preference thing. Those people are willing to upend the notion of a high trust society for a couple extra quid.
Yeah, no, it's one of the saddest thing that I was writing this piece for my Substack, and I haven't finished yet, but it's on how the state de-incentivized charity, and it made it difficult for when it's made it difficult for anybody to actually do charity because of all the tax laws and everything, and then it's de-incentivized. People look at a problem and go, "Oh, well, the state will take care of that, or they already have someone to take care of that, so I don't need to help these people. That guy's on welfare; he's being helped already." And it really like the people would help people helped them more before the government got involved trying to help people. It de-incentivized the active charity, which it's just a disaster. It's causing more problems. It's fixing problems, causing more problems, and no one's trying to fix the problems and cause more problems. It's Mises had the idea an invention breeds more socialism. The same thing here. It's like we're gonna solve the problem, then not solve the problem. People are gonna see it and ignore it. The problem gets worse, and we can solve the problem again, 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 and keep growing the welfare state, and keep growing this process. It really is Mises' middle socialism, because the government doesn't have to do anything; has to claim they're going to do something.
No, there is. I forget how. I say I shouldn't forget. I'm always reminded how nicely Hopper is able to take certain sort of points kind of out of nowhere. So the last sort of sentence, the first paragraph here, he has essentially given an entire sort of defence for property and exchange and freedom of association as the cornerstones of like civil society. It's just kind of so lovely. What this boils down to is simply that peaceful cooperation between humans is a perfectly natural and constantly re-emerging phenomenon. And out of this cooperation, then, and equally naturally and equally driven by self-interest, comes capital formation and money. The medium of exchange and the division of labour ultimately expands to the entire globe. And likewise, money, commodity money, also becomes a worldwide used commodity money. I don't know why he has to say it twice, but oh well. Material living standards increase for everyone, and based on higher material living standards, an ever more elaborate superstructure of non-material goods, that is, civilization, science, arts, literature, and so forth, can be developed and maintained. I will say, however, I think I would partially take issue with the bottom there a little bit. I don't see any inherent relationship between a material living standard and an ability to produce art per se. I get the point he's coming at, but. And I've read too much of Ola
No, I, yeah, that's how I put it. I agree with you on that point. Like, I don't know if that's 100% great, but I get where it's coming from, you know. So I want to, you know.
now. Are
Nah,
you gonna
I'm just
defer
leaving
to
with
Hopper
that.
and let him away with it?
I'm going to if you when in doubt, defer to Hopper. That's my policy.
I mean, that's not the worst policy in the world. No, there is then. I'm just trying to remember where I am in my notes here quickly. I should have. See, I did all these things and I didn't match the pages where they should have been. Hindsight,
My
2020,
problem is I took
though.
notes in my school notebook today because I was listening to it, and I left the notebook at the in the classroom, and then I came home and said I have this new notebook that I took this 5 minutes ago, and so it's not full of anything. I had wrote down sites and things I wanted to say, and I don't have any of it.
F.
So I'm trying to go from memory over here.
That'll do. it continues on in the next section. But something can and obviously has happened that disrupts and distorts or even derails this normal self-interest driven development. And this is, of course, the state, which I will define initially rather abstractly as a compulsorily funded territorial monopolist of protection, that is, a monopolist of defence and the provision and enforcement of law and order. Now, how does a state originate? Well, this is generally, and I think intentionally, confused. It should be made clear right from the outset that law and order, or protection of property, and state law, and state order, and state protection are not one and the same thing. They are not identical things. Which sounds like a weird kind of tautologist point, but when you start to, as you suggest, the state gets to a point where it doesn't do anything anymore. It doesn't actually provide law and order. It just says it's going to keep doing it. And in doing so, what state law provides is actually chaos.
Yes. Yeah, it's like the cops will fail to catch drug. A really good example. The cops are going to say, we're going to fight the war on drugs. They don't actually fight the war on drugs. Conservatives see more drugs in the street and say, we need more money for the cops. And then it just keeps growing it. You can just claim they're going to fix the problem, never actually fix it, and just keep growing it, keep lining their pockets. Honestly, if it wasn't so evil, it'd be genius.
Well, no, it's the same sort of idea you see in Sam Francis when he talks about anarcho-tyranny. This notion that to him it was an inherent problem in managerialism, and maybe he was sort of looking at something on the surface that was actually an inherent sort of economic and organizational problem, which I think is also a valid point. The opposite, he's trying to suggest that it's not just a problem of managerial organizations, it's a problem of all organizations, and it's just within managerial organizations we begin to see the separation of what we know to be law and order, property, trade, freedom of association and disassociation, your ability to actually discriminate on your own grounds and declare justice on your own grounds, maybe in some sort of communal or sort of covenant sense, as it were. Once that no longer exists and is replaced by laws that, actually put forward egalitarian premises as opposed to propertarian premises, if you want to call them that, and you no longer have these powers to discriminate anymore, that law and that order, as much as it still stands for that in name, actually seeks to sow the exact opposite.
Yeah, it's I think he has a point. I want to touch back on this in a bit, but he brings up something about this later in the piece that I think I'll use the opportunity to kind of bring up a point I have.
Cool.
See.
Just as property and social cooperation is based on division of labour are natural, so the human desire to have one's property protected against natural and social disasters, such as crime, is a completely natural desire. In order to satisfy this desire, there is first and foremost self-protection, precaution, insurance, individual or cooperative, vigilance, self-defence, and punishment. I do love the fact he's got punishment at the end of it there. That's when you know you're reading Hoppe and not some other libertarian writing, is because he's like directly like, yeah, you need punishment.
Yeah.
And let there be absolutely no doubt as to the effectiveness of a protection system based on people's willingness to defend themselves. This is how law and order was maintained for most of the time for most of mankind. In every village, even up to this day, law and order is basically maintained in this way. The American Wild West, which was not exactly wild as compared to the current situation, that's the way law and order was maintained, by people being willing to defend themselves. I mean, this is a point that anyone that reads leftist history doesn't seem to get at all. They seem to, you know, the French Revolution happens and all of a sudden this great body is spawned that defends all people from all realms. And it is the total sort of republican state. And they seem to think that no one prior to that was ever capable of, like, actually saying that something was theirs and then holding on to it.
Yeah. No, it's... Leftist view of... Like, anytime I read leftist talk about history, I'm like... who was this? I was reading, oh, fuck, I can't remember who it was. I was reading some leftist on history, and I'm like, I think you're making the point, but I don't think that's accurate. Like, I get the point you're trying to make, but I don't think that... Like, let me go check some revisionist Misesian history here and see if that's the case.
But no, it's, you know, you can begin to see the trade-off as justice is no longer the thing that society wants to produce, or protection of property is no longer the thing that society wants to produce. It wants to produce, instead, state law and order in a way that grants the state power and economic profit as priorities. These things just completely erode. And again, in that sort of sense, the value of these previous structures are completely eroded and essentially extracted from the people by the sort of centralising force that attempts to monopolise, in a sense, that Hobbes is talking about. Where should we continue on to? Yeah, I mean, it goes on to make the sort of longer point here, as he says, you know, if the state eventually monopolises, you will end up with no competition, so that there is no reason for people not to think long term about the actual survival of the society and its own protection in that sense, and instead they sort of disregard this idea that the thing's going to last any length of time because, well, it's theirs, and it's theirs for good because there's no competitors anymore, so they get to just rinse it for what it's worth.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, no, he's essentially just saying that once one person begins to declare themselves the king of racketeering, just expect their racketeering to get worse. It's... And the standard Austrian economics predicts, once there is no longer free entry into the business of property protection, or any other business for that matter, the price of protection will rise and the quality of protection will fall. The monopolist will become increasingly less of a protector of our property and an increasingly more a protection racket, or even a systemic exploiter of property owners. He will become an aggressor against and a destroyer of the people and their property that he was initially supposed to protect. Now, what is easily described in abstract terms, monopoly, is in practice a painstaking and lengthy task. How can anyone get away with barring all other protectors from competition? And why would the people, and especially the excluded other potential peacemakers and judges, allow such a thing to happen? That one individual monopolises this service? Now, the answer regarding the origin of the state is in detail very complicated, but in its general structure is very easy to recognise. First, every state that is every monopolistic protection agency must begin, or can only originate, at an extremely small territorial level, such as a village, which is... Again, it's one of those points you see in Slightly in Burnham, in Francis and also in Kaczynski, where there is a recognition, or sorry, there is a recognizing of scale of the central institution or the central structure, be it whatever, Francis saw as the managerial state, as did Burnham, and Ted Kaczynski sees it as the technological society. For that structure to centralize and gather more landmass, it must by its very nature become more complex so that it can manage that greater landmass to justify itself taking more. And we end up seeing again this sort of perpetual relationship of this monopolistic beast kind of just carrying on and doing as it pleases, because it's a self-justifying machine, or at least attempts to be.
Yeah, no, I guess it brings to the point later on schools, and that is exactly what the public schools are. It justifies, it's the state justifies its own existence through the acts of the state. It's completely circular.
I mean, what I do like is the fact, though, that he doesn't attempt to. He isn't necessarily attempting to apologize for this, but he's making a sort of quite nuanced point later, where he suggests that the second thing we have to notice is that not just anyone becomes a local protection monopoly, rather, the local protection monopolists are initially members of the natural social elite. That is, they are initially accomplished and acknowledged members of society. They were also, before they reached the position of a monopolist, previously chosen voluntarily as protectors, only as established and recognised elites whose authority is essentially voluntary, is it possible for them to make this decisive step towards monopolisation and get away with it. Which is a kind of admittance that this is, this isn't something that happens by the masses, which is what we're always told, as the state comes about through the masses choosing to imbue their consent into the king or into the republic, or just through voting that justifies the state itself. And the inverse of that relationship is that once you no longer have the circulation of elites from genuine elites within society, you have a circulation of people who aren't actually elites in any way, shape, or form.
No, yeah, absolutely. Like, have you read Harper's little pamphlet, "Intellectuals," just "Elites in the State," I think it's called. Hang on.
I think I've read one similar. There's the is one of the opening essays in The Great Fiction is
I think it
Intellectuals in
is.
Society.
I think that's it. He Harper's written a bit about intellectuals and elites, and it's a fascinating topic. And this point he makes here that there are no really natural elites anymore. These people that are just bad. Not like not even they're not that bad, like they're evil, but they're just not impressive. Like, we don't have impressive elites anymore. I think it was Tucker Carlson. He said on his news show one time, he said, "I'm not against elites. I just want impressive ones. All the ones we have now suck." And it's absolutely true. We have no one to. There's no competition. There's no power struggle between elites that we can see. Every elite's kind of on the same page. It's and the ones that you do it, like, the most impressive elite we have is like Elon Musk,
Well, so
and
yeah,
that's it.
it smacks of something like Carlyle. We've got all these sham captains and the all these sort of, Boba the sausage maker and all these sort of meme characters that he came up with that are these sort of representations of a really sort of shallow idea of greatness. And it's why we end up with all these boring cookie cutter sort of professional politicians, because they're not real people. Because if they were real people with some at least slither of greatness throughout them, you wouldn't be able to corral them in the way that they need to be to keep the whole show running.
Absolutely, yeah. It's so, yeah. I found it. It's a natural elite intellectuals in the state. That was the one I was referencing. It's a little pamphlet. It's phenomenal. Okay, where were we at? I lost my space.
We are just about the heading that says the impossibility of limited government. I'm just sort of picking through it, really.
Okay, no problem. See, I can't remember where he brings it up, but somewhere in here he brings up the point of no one one of the problems is a state monopoly on law and legality, not just enforcement, but what the law is people don't longer question the law, what is right, what is wrong, whatever the law says.
Yeah, no, that's what I meant by the point earlier on. I mean, it's the way I always try and explain it to people is that, conservative people say they believe in law and order, and their image of law and order in their head is a higher moral sort of justice, and if they actually hold any proper ideas of it. But when they turn around to the government and they ask for that, they get state law and order and they get told to be happy about it, if you
And
get what I mean.
they usually are happy about it, which is the sad part.
It depends who it is, I suppose, but yes.
Yeah.
No,
It's
I suppose we can carry on. I remember the limited government one's fair enough, but it's a point that's sort of we've kind of killed to death already. The one of the big sort of sections in here that is one of the key things that really begins to cement what Hoppe has said is what seem sometimes like this, unconnected. Little snippets of human behaviour that you said, well, if this is the case, then ergo this. And you begin
Yeah.
to see its effects on a much larger scale when society is no longer ordered under monarchy, but ordered under some sort of constitutional democracy or republic or, and how many issues you get from that. It becomes. It's a subject in and of itself that I think I've done so much reading about now.
Okay, it's I'll tell you. Reading Hoppe has been mind blowing. Like I think listening to Pico Nones and reading Hoppe and Yavin have really just reshaped everything. Like in the past 6 months, my entire mind is just reshaped. Like I think 12 times now, I've had everything I believed in just destroyed and then rebuilt and then destroyed again. But it's already different people I've been reading. It's been a wild 6 months.
No, I mean, I don't know if I've been quite as rapid, but it's nice to know that even as I look to and read stuff that is very out of the liberal frame or even directly against the liberal frame, there are still lessons from Hoppe that can be sort of channeled and thought about. In the same way that Burnham, to a lot of people, was. They thought he had no spine to a certain extent because he seemed to just go along with wherever the best power was. But if you read him properly, what he's saying is if your goal in politics is to accrue power and hold it, which it probably should be, then you should at least learn the lessons from these people. And Hoppe is kind of doing a
Absolutely.
similar thing with, if this is the greater thing from Hoppe would take from it and say, if this is how the state operates, then this is how we must think about it at all times.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I've been doing to kind of do the plug real quick. On my podcast, I did Machiavellians and then Suicide of the West. Then I'm gonna do Man's Year of Revolution. Then I'm doing Paul Gottfried's book, Therapeutic State, which he opens up saying we've gone from. Sorry, his book Man's Year, Multiculturalism, which opens up with how he moved from a managerial state to a therapeutic state. And then I'm doing Reclaiming the American Right by Raimondo, which opens with a critique of Burnham. And so I'm going through a whole Burnham's work, where his work has gone. A critique of him on about 2 months, so it's been a lot of fun. I've been to Suicide West has been one of my favorite books, I think. It's incredible.
See, it's kind of funny now because I look back on that and I realise how much stuff Academic Agent took out of that book to frame his conversations he has with people. It's really funny.
I've only ever watched a little bit of him. I've watched him with Yavin. I need to actually go back and watch more of his stuff.
Well, no, that sort of circle of people I tend to follow along with quite a bit, so I've been trying to keep up with a lot of the reading. And I don't know, when it gets to the books that then cost hundreds of pounds, I can't, but
Yeah, I feel you.
anyway, we'll continue with this for a bit. However,
Where are we
even
at?
apart from this, as soon as a protection monopoly exists for any given sized territory, the monopolist will try to intensify his exploitation and increase his income and wealth at the expense of the protected subjects to the maximum extent possible. As long as a monopoly is held by a single person, like a prince or a king, and especially when it is a hereditary monopoly, then it is in the monopolist's interest, because he owns a monopoly in the capital value of it, to preserve the value of his property. He'll exploit little day in order to exploit more tomorrow. Popular resistance against expansion of state power will be very high if there is a single person in charge, because there is obviously no free entry into the state apparatus. and the benefit of the monopoly accrued to a single man and his extended family, that is, the hereditary nobility. Accordingly, the public resentment and vigilance is heightened, and attempts to intensify exploitation find quick and severe limitations. People hated the king because they realised that he is the ruler and we are ruled by him, which is such an obvious point, but again, it's another one of those ones you seem to have to explain to people. Like, nowadays, people are, they're angry at Parliament, and they're angry at the MPs, and they're angry at the media, and they're angry at this and that, but when things were all done through the king, they were just angry at the king.
Yeah,
because
he was
the boss.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that's that was my first major red pill or idea of monarchy wasn't terrible was a meme, and it was just two soy boy Rojacks going, oh no, this is Congress is bad, the media is bad, all the other things are bad, and the president's retarded, and it cuts to the two chads and it said the king's retarded, we should kill him, and that was it, that was the meme.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, that makes sense. I mean, what was it, the monarchy is one bullet away from a solution. And I saw that, I'm like, oh, so maybe the idea of conflict resolution being faster is probably a good thing. And that's when I started going down a monarchy rabbit hole.
Well, it's the implicit threat is always over the head of a singular monarch who declares himself as sovereign publicly. You know, that then comes with a, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, as they say. Predictably, a great push forward in the state's desire for intensified exploitation occurred only in conjunction with the reform of the state drawn out over centuries from a princely to a democratic state under modern majoritarian democracy, that is, the type of state that came into full bloom after World War I on a worldwide scale. The monopoly and exploitation do not disappear. Majoritarian democracy is not a system of self-rule and self-defence. State and people are not one and the same thing. With the substitution of an elected parliament and presidents for an unelected prince or king, protection remains as much as a monopoly as it was before. Which is a really nice point, once again, that relates to a lot of the elite theorists. I mean, you will find in the Machiavellians itself, which isn't too in-depth a book, you know, the basic points from Mosca and people like Michels when they openly suggest that democracy itself is a tactic employed by the elites to garner more power for their class, not to empower the class below. And, you know, there was a number of reasons why it's not even feasibly possible. But the trick itself is just, all you need to do is just say it constantly and you can just sort of fool the people into it. What happens is this: the territorial protection monopoly becomes now public rather than private property. Instead of a prince who regards it as a private property, a temporary and interchangeable caretaker is put in charge of the protection racket. The caretaker does not own the protection racket, instead he's just allowed to use the current resources for his own advantage. He owns usufruct, but he does not own the capital value. This does not eliminate the self-interest-driven tendency toward exploitation. To the contrary, it only makes exploitation less rational and less calculating and more short-sighted and more wasteful. Which is the sort of just basic idea that your predation breeds more predation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's something I picked up from, I had Poppy Liberty, Andrew, on my podcast talking about covenant communities in the Old Testament. And that's something that we... In the Old Testament, it says, and they acted in sinful ways, and God removed his protection. And you can read that as they disobeyed God, he removed the protection. Or you read it as they were doing degenerate things, and that brought on more degenerate things and made them weaker and weaker, so they were attacked. And so even if appear like this natural, it's a way of reading that you can read in the Old Testament, predation led to, degeneracy, but the degeneracy was led to predation, which led to more predation, which led to destruction. So, tales of the time.
Moreover, because entry into a democratic government is open, everyone can become president. Resistance against state property invasions is reduced. This leads to the same result. Increasingly, under democratic conditions, the worst will rise to the top of the state in free competition. Competition is not always good. Competition in the field of becoming the shrewdest aggressor against private property is nothing to be greeted. And this is precisely what democracy amounts to. I mean, what a fantastic phrase that one is.
That is just fantastic.
But this is, this racket is only possible because of a lesson people worked out, in the bloody 1500s, 1600s, when they started writing the early reactions to social contract theory, that you can't put power into the people. They can't do anything with it because it's too diffuse. They can't exercise it. Even in voting, it doesn't really work. So you just end up with this, the same class of people engaging in the same behaviour they did before. They just get away with it more than they used to.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I have nothing to add to that. It's spot on.
I do like that he carries on here. Princes and kings were dilettantes and rulers, and normally had a good measure of natural elite upbringing and value system, so as to act often enough simply as a good household father would have done. Democratic politicians, on the other hand, are and must be professional demagogues, constantly appealing even to the basest, and that is typically egalitarian instincts, as every vote is obviously as good as any other. That's a great point. And because publicly elected politicians are never held personally accountable for official public service, they are far more dangerous from the viewpoint of those who want their property to be protected and want security than any king has ever been. If you combine these two tendencies that I mentioned, inherent in a state, intensification, exploiting the domestic population, and extensification, then you get a one-world democracy with a one-world paper currency issued by a one-world central bank.
That entire bit right here, from monarchy versus democracy down to here, is just incredible. It just sums up so much so well that I might just copy and paste that and send it to some people.
Yeah, and then he gets into at this moment, let me t simply take stock. Here we are at the end of the 20th century, closer never to the end state of a one world state, at least closer never before in history. The United States is the sole superpower and the world's top cop. At the same time, democracy has become almost universal and the world's leading power. The United States is the world's leading champion of democracy. That down with Imperial Satan. Boo.
Yeah, I'm with you there. We suck. I go outside and look around, and it's like, ah, fuck, I hate it here.
Some neoconservatives, such as Francis Fukuyama, pointed out that this must be the end of history. One world democracy. We almost reached it. Now, from an Austro-libertarian point of view, matters look somewhat different. Under highly centralized democracy, or let me call it highly centralized mob rule, the security of private property has almost completely disappeared. The price of protection is enormous, and the quality of justice dispensed has gone downhill constantly. It has deteriorated to the point where the idea of immutable laws of justice and natural law has almost entirely disappeared from public consciousness. I think this is what you were trying to bring up earlier on. Law is considered nothing but state-made law, positive law. Law and justice is whatever the state says it is. There is still private property in name, but in practice, private property owners have been almost completely expropriated.
That right there,
Rather
that
than
point right here about private property, it doesn't really exist much nowadays. That was a huge debate. I remember a few weeks ago on Twitter, or maybe months ago on Twitter, was arguing about, like, do people actually still have private property? And I say no. And Apple kind of makes a great point here that, yeah, we don't really, no one really owns property because they have to pay, even if you own your property, but for owning in quotation marks, you still have to constantly rent it. You're really just renting it from the state. Like, you don't get to own anything.
Well,
You own nothing to be happy about it. We're already sort of there.
you are handed a license for that property, not the deed, which is a very legalese way of looking at it. But that is the very subtle distinction between the same thing he's talking previously, where he says that he owns a usufruct, but he does not own the capital value in reference to Republican leaders. They physically cannot claim that the central organizing body and the land that it takes belongs to them. They can only say that they are managing it in some sense. And in the same sense here, you don't own your property. As soon as you say you want to exclude somebody of one type of race or something, then in comes the government and civil rights and
I mean, you don't. I mean, you own a business, and you can't turn away anybody. It's you. I'm tired of this, acting like we own, you own your property. We live in a property rights society. It's like we're so far removed from a property rights society. We shouldn't argue as if we are even close to that.
Yeah.
It is a complete waste of time.
Well, no, it's very nice here that he's sort of doing the thing that some people need to be drilled into their head, because they still celebrate the aspects of, capitalism or free trade or even maybe liberalism as the way in which we have got to where we are now, in some sense. And that seems to be completely off. I mean, what we have lived in since probably at least post-World War II, if not probably earlier, has been some variation of at least a socialism, if not budging on some sort of weird techno-communism as we get closer and closer to whatever's coming next. So that, he's sort of trying to drive the point home here that the sort of society that you're looking for is radically different from the one we actually live in now. And to recognise the successes of the society we have now as the successes of sort of property and a proper private law is erroneous and it's wrong.
It's I mean, one of my main critiques of most like libertarian AnCap people is they're philosophizing midstream. They're taking what they would their utopia, the society to be like, and the principles they would live under, and applying those same principles today that they already live under them. It's a compl it's they cap a sand ahead. They're philosophizing midstream. They're not there yet, and they need to get there before they can start being what they want to be.
There is, I think, a point to be made, though, especially from what Hoppe is saying here. If you begin to think about these things in a more Machiavellian sense, you begin to come up with what maybe is a more effective strategy. I mean, we're almost sort of 50 minutes in already, and we're only about a third through this, so I don't know if we'll entirely get to all of the strategy stuff. But it should become quite obvious as we continue on and we keep describing as, what he's claiming here is the current conditions. Moreover, private property owners are no longer free to include or exclude other people from their property as they see fit. This is the right to include if you want or exclude if you want is an essential ingredient of private property, and this entails a defence mechanism. It is an anti-invasion method that you can kick people off your property, but this right to kick people off your property, especially commercial property, has been entirely taken away from you. I mean, the There is, I think, what was it? Oh, I can't even remember the phrase now. I tweeted something out the other day that was completely relevant to this. Yeah. What I was going to say was that you can tell the effectiveness of modern public education by trying to explain to people that freedom of association also implies freedom of disassociation, and that they can't see that these two concepts are sort of intrinsically linked in any kind of way. It really makes me worry sometimes that you try and explain a concept like that to someone and it seems to be totally alien to them. They seem to think that for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years of human history, it was just that whites and blacks forced each other to live in separate areas and then civil rights happened. And that sort of organising societies by individual choice on property that's never something they even think about.
Yeah, no. When I first came to ANCAP, I had people arguing with me at like parties about civil rights law and how I must be against them because I was an anarchist. And it was just like you don't get it. These laws, the Jim Crow laws, they were Jim Crow laws to begin with. Like they don't understand history, and they think they do. And you're trying to tell someone a fact, and they're like, "Oh, you're just reading into it." It's like, no, I'm telling you a fact. You're reading what people way out of it. It's infuriating. It's like trying to a great example of something I know history. So I talked to Andy Kinstead about Lincoln. Like, I mean, God, I mean, I've debated the people from the Claremont Institute, which is like a big name institute in America, about Lincoln, and it's just been like pulling teeth. They won't admit that this guy was evil, and they just like, no, he was good because he was a Republican and he's the first one, and they can't. By their own standards, how they judge other presidents, they would hate Lincoln. They don't know history, and it's so foreign to them, they can't even grasp it.
Oh, right. Continuing. The state, which was supposed to protect us, has in fact rendered us completely helpless. It robs its subjects of more than half their income to be distributed according to public sentiment rather than according to principles of justice. Its subjects are property to thousands of arbitrary and invasive regulations. We can no longer freely hire and fire whoever we want. We can no longer freely fire, or sorry, fire, or for whatever reason we deem good and necessary. We cannot sell or buy whatever we want to whoever we want and wherever we want. We cannot charge prices freely as we wish. We cannot associate and disassociate, separate ourselves with whoever we want or with whoever we do not want. Instead of protecting us, then, the state has delivered us and our property to the mob and mob instincts. Instead of safeguarding us, it impoverishes. It destroys our families, local organisations, private foundations, clubs and associations by drawing all of them increasingly into its own orbit. And the result of all of this, the state has perverted the public sense of justice and a personal one of personal responsibility, and bred and attracted an increasing number of moral and economic monsters and monstrosities. I mean, this is the exact same model we see in something like the Juvenile, or the further sort of extension of that in Bond's work with Nemesis, or even in sort of Burnham or Francis, this idea that there is a necessity to destroy the old world and its institutions for some form of centralizing power or control.
Sorry, excuse me. Please continue with your reading or something. I had a bit of a cough.
It's all right. But no, I think it begins to sort of come round to what Hopper's, it's maybe not quite as simple as seeing it, but he's essentially saying, if we are being exploited and all our institutions have been smashed in the name of some other group's search for power, then really our only option is to turn round and do the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
And essentially, I mean, at one point here, he says people need to understand fundamental insights about private property, law, justice, and law enforcement is essential to any human society, but there's no reason whatsoever why this task must be taken on by one single agency, by a monopolist. As a matter of fact, it's precisely the case that as soon as you have a monopolist taking on this task, he will, with necessity, destroy justice and render us defenseless against foreign as well as domestic invaders and aggressors. It is then one's ultimate goal, which one has to keep in mind, is the demonopolisation of protection and justice. Protection, security, defence, law, order, and arbitration in conflicts can and must be supplied competitively. That is, entry into the field of being a judge must be free. I mean, he's making the late Rothbard point here of, deputise as you please and send in the cops. Actually just take the role of distributing justice away from the state and whatever scale you can.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's... what was it? I think privatized statecraft, but popular liberty says calls it. You need to control what statecraft there is. Like, run the school board, control your school board, and then control your police. Be I said before, if libertarians didn't hate cops so much, we need some libertarian sheriffs.
Yeah, no, exactly. If you hate the state, then you should make it your sole goal to make the state into something that's slightly less hateful. And yes. I don't mean that in the sense that it's got to have hate crime laws. I mean, it probably produces more hate than it would now.
Absolutely.
Second, because a monopoly of protection is the root of all evil, any territorial expansion of such a monopoly is per se evil too. Every political centralization must be on principle grounds rejected. In turn, every attempt at political decentralization, segregation, separation, secession, and so forth, must be supported. I mean, I wonder at some point, like, when do we start the Westboro Baptist Church Libertarian Party Twitter account and see like how many people freak out as you try and then support them as like a secessionist movement who want to look past state law. Like, if people were really serious about what he's talking about here, then that would be the sort of people they would champion. They would go out and champion the Ruby Ridges, the Wacos, the all these different people, Randy Weaver and all that, those types, because they essentially says, no, we're not doing this whole monopoly nonsense. We'll live as we please here and do justice as we please. But no, those
Absolutely.
things don't get defended. The Westboro
No,
Baptist Church is too, oh, it's too racist and homophobic and transphobic, so you can't do that.
yeah, no, it's I think it bugged me when I first became a libertarian. I was like, oh, I could actually disagree with all these people but still support their right to, go off and beat them or do their own thing. Like, self-segregation is good. And I said that to somebody, and they were like, how can you say that? We need to have a multicultural, like, hub of everybody working together. I'm like, no, so, like, hate is great, self-segregation is good, let people be on their own and just succeed and be their own community, not allowed to join. And it was, it's, I mean, for me, it's like, that's like basic sense. From like, basic libertarian ideas, that would make sense. But someone wants a modern libertarian and just like small government liberalism, and they can't get out of that framework, and it's frustrating.
The sort of inverse of that is identified by the less behavior, and it's how you can identify them as not operating as a monolith, because the vast majority of people who are, like normie leftists who aren't extremely involved or extremely read up, they probably want to be left alone from right-wing people, and if they could, they would. Whereas the top sort of flight leftists know that they can't leave the right-wingers on their own, because they'll go over and percolate and make something, and they'll make something of themselves. So they have to attack them constantly, and they can't leave them alone. So that's why you end up with that weird paradox of them supposedly want nothing to do with us, but they'll never bloody leave us alone.
That is a great point.
The third basic insight is that a democratic protection monopoly, in particular, must be rejected as a moral and economic perversity, which I think is a fantastic phrase. He's essentially suggesting that, democracy is a conscious development by people who are looking to scam you.
He's great. I love. I'm having a great. I'm having a great time just reading Hopper, because this to be. I'll be thinking something like I was thinking about this the other day, and he just sums it up so well. He was like, "Oh, that's exactly how I would want to say that."
Majority rule and private property protection are incompatible. The idea of democracy must be ridiculed. It is nothing else but mob rule parading as justice. To be labelled a democrat must be considered the worst of all possible compliments. This does not mean that one may not participate in democratic policies. I will come to this a little bit later. But one must use democratic means only for defensive purposes. That is, one may use an anti-democratic platform to be elected by an anti-democratic constituency to implement anti-democratic, that is, anti-egalitarian and pro-private property policies. I mean, there is a what he's basically saying there, through all that convoluted bit of text, is Lenin talking about expropriating.
Excuse me.
That's all right. Is Lenin talking about expropriating the bourgeoisie for what they thought it was worth, because the bourgeoisie follow the wrong ideas and they expropriate us. And he's essentially saying here that, the systems and the institutions that they have built through, these methods of pandering that they refer to as popular sovereignty and democracy, take these tools and stab them in the back with it.
Absolutely.
I mean,
Not.
I keep joking to people the fact that I'm afraid the solution to 1984 might actually be 1933, because we need that kind of revolutionary figure to run on a democratic platform as, who genuinely believes that this is it. The democratic game ends here, which is almost a point you even see in Marx. I mean, he talks about, I think he uses the phrase winning the game of democracy, which to me is not him suggesting that what they need to do is win the vote. They need to be the people who get to say that democracy is over, and that we are the new political force. It will not be the popular sovereignty that decides who holds power. It'll be us.
Yeah,
And it's,
that group already exists, and we just gotta become that group. That group just claims democracy.
yes.
We gotta become the elites. That's actually why I love what's his name, Jason Sabrentz's Most Power and Influence. Like, or what's his name? Hope of Jesus wants to become a millionaire, so or like a billionaire, so he can fund other people who are like him and create his own class of elites.
See,
That's genius.
I used to like his stuff, got a bit busy. He has me blocked me on Twitter for calling him the N-word.
Okay. I guess that's a reason to block someone. Okay.
I mean, it was like in a book. I mean, like I sent him a tweet, and the title of the book was like "Cap" or was it a "Capitalist N Word" or something? I was like, "This you?" Question mark. Or to put it differently, a person is not honourable because he's democratically elected. If anything, this makes him a suspect. Despite the fact that a person has been elected democratically, he may still be a decent and honourable man. We have heard one before. I wonder which ones he's talking about. I only know a small number of people genuinely elected on a democratic platform, Mr. Hopper, and they weren't people that everyone else likes. From these principles, we now come to the problem of application. The basic insight that as monopolized protection, a state will inevitably become an aggressor and lead to defenselessness and political centralization and democracy are means of extensifying and intensifying exploitation and aggression. While these basic insights give us a general direction and the goal, they are obviously not yet sufficient to define our actions and tell us how to get there. How can the goal of demonopolized protection and justice possibly be implemented given the present circumstances of centralized almost world democracy? As at least temporarily our starting point from which we have to begin, let me try to develop an answer to this question by elaborating what is the response to the problem. Yeah, it goes on to essentially describe here, the problem from 1914 was comparatively small and the possible solution was comparatively easy then. He's discussing the fact that even at the start of World War One, you have a lot of kings. You have, I think this idea of the patchwork sort of society that he would like to build, and he talks about a little bit about here, was much more feasible, and there wasn't all this baggage of things like the welfare state and public health that would allow the political class to defend their own position of power by declaring themselves essentially as the guardians of these sort of public services and the guarantor of these rights.
You know, absolutely. He brought up Patrick. He brings up a Patrick a few times in this thing, and it's kind of funny because I just finished reading Patrick by Yarvin last week, and so it's kind of funny to compare these patchworks.
Yes.
It's interesting.
I mean, I think he goes on to say here, it's essentially saying, the process of decentralization through non-violent political means handled by a small number of elites within the system was maybe possible. And prior to 1914, he says, the mid-19th century, and he tries, first upon this declaration. Would or at first everyone upon this declaration would have regained his unrestricted right to self-defence. He would have been free to decide if he wanted more or better protection than that afforded by self-defence, and if so, where and from whom to secure this protection. Most people in this situation undoubtedly would have chosen to take advantage of the division of labour and rely, in addition to self-defence, also on specialised protectors. And I think he's sort of given a bit of a kind of frankly autistic example, but I understand why he's done it. As if some form is given to the king where he declares that, he's still the arbiter of some central body, but it is not a monopolistic body, and that he would be writing some sort of declaration to say that if the people chose to serve some other authority for justice, that they would be allowed to do that. And he sort of draws out this point that realistically that could happen there, because one of the key things you would need is some form of alternative set of elites to pick up the essentially competing with the king, and you don't have those anymore. So that's half the problem, is the very people required to take over from the monopoly now don't actually exist.
Like, we don't have, like I said earlier, we don't have any elites. Like, we have no elites that would be competition for the states or that would want to work outside of the states. Like it's kind of it sucks really. It just kind of sucks. Like you read history, you're like, oh, I've got these like great elites and dukes and business owners who actually had power and influence, and now you look at everyone now and it's like all elites are Kim Kardashian who tried to get prison reform. Like that's the most like the most respectable elite I could think of is Kim Kardashian because he actually tried to help people in prisons. It's just sad.
Yeah, I remember this chapter being a bit lengthy, and it's just kind of going over a lot of the points that would be obvious from stuff before. I mean, he's discussing, patchwork structure, protection and defense improves protection. Monopolistic contiguous defensive presumes, does or defense presumes that the security interests of the entire population living in a given territory are somehow homogeneous. That is, that all people in a given territory have the same sort of defense interests. But this is a highly unrealistic and actually untrue assumption. I mean, this is kind of a weird point, but if you pre-exist in a world where there is, say, just the king and the judges locally and the church and whatever else, then you probably actually have some kind of idea of what you need resources-wise to defend yourself. And that you, in a sense, are making economic choices when you decide how much money or how much grain or what things you no longer seek in your free time, so that you can guarantee security for yourself. And that people don't have that ability anymore once that all these things are guaranteed for them. It's a bit like like learned helplessness from Kaczynski or something like that, where because they no longer exercise this meaningful sort of power over their own self, in the sense of the knowing that they defend themselves, and maybe even having to execute that ability of defending themselves every once in a while, as opposed to having cops running around doing it for you. It builds a completely different mindset. And if you were to try and take away state police from people nowadays, they would panic because they don't have the knowledge or the experience with actually knowing how to defend themselves or how to guarantee justice in some sort of sense.
No, it's what does he call it? Kaczynski's oh my God, he just said it was
Learned
they don't have the
helplessness.
learned, yeah, that one. I keep referencing that idea, but keep forgetting what that term is called. I'm gonna put that down real quick. No, it's absolutely true. It's like people are just so it's one of the, in my opinion, one of the worst things the state has done to affect people is they've taken away any of the responsibility and power of people. Like claim that it will do it for you, and people now don't help each other. People don't want to learn to do things. People have become dependent on the state in a way that wasn't the norm. And now, if we did get rid of the state, people would have to become dependent. And that, I argue with my friends, all my friends are IRL or commies. And so we'll argue these kind of things, and they'll be like, okay, what would these people do without the state? And I'm like, learn to survive? And they're like, they wouldn't. I'm like, that's not my problem. But I get where they're coming from. It's like people are dependent on it now, and it's terrible.
Well, see, I think the part of the point there is that there is always some level of dependency, and again, to sort of take Hoppe and then take him a point further, as if there must be this element of dependency, then what's the right level, and should people be able to dictate that level, or say at some point, no, that's too much, I'm not interested. As much as a bit of a weird way to look at it, it's. That's essentially what he's saying, and people there needs to be some level of competition where people can freely discriminate about how much dependency they want to have.
Absolutely.
There is.
I don't know what it is, but here's this great point about how the old ways of change used to be just convert the guy in swords
Yeah, no,
to
I
your
think
ideas.
there
But
is a. I think it
I
might
don't know
be in
where it
here
is.
somewhere in the next, because there's a lot of like really great, some of these stuff would be great even just standalone sort of statements, because I love the, today after less than one century of mass democracy, there exists no such natural elites and social hierarchies which one could immediately turn to for protection. Natural elites and hierarchical social orders and organizations, that is, people and institutions commanding an authority and respect independent of the state, are even more intolerable and unacceptable to a democrat and more incompatible with the democratic spirit of egalitarianism than they were a threat to any king or to any prince. and because of that, under the democratic rules of the game, all independent authorities, all independent institutions have been systematically wiped out or diminished through economic measures to insignificance. Today, no one person or institution outside of government itself possesses genuine national or even regional authority. Rather than people of independent authority, we now merely have an abundance of people who are prominent sports and movie stars, pop stars, and of course politicians. But these people, while they may be able to sell trends and shape fashions, do not possess any such thing as a natural personal social authority. I mean, he's sort of making a point here that you begin to see, as you will get into Gottfried's stuff on the therapeutic state, that is, as you know, the therapeutic state is a phenomenon we can see as the managerialists of the late 19th century, as they come into the 20th century, understand that there are sentiments that they need to breed out of society in a certain sense. I mean, some of them did see this in a eugenicist sort of lens, so that mass organisation could become more efficient and more slick, because they felt they could perfect man through this way. But in doing so, there's a sort of Machiavellian assertion there that they need to develop a system that is sort of like, I don't know what the phrase would be, but it's you know, again, it has to be self-perpetuating. It has to develop its own elites who are completely immunised from any form of actual will or spirit or notion of wanting to grasp power, because the system couldn't survive if these people did actually exist and could compete it.
Yeah. Excuse me.
This is true in particular of politicians. They may be great stars now every day that they are on TV and subject to public debate, but this is almost entirely due to the fact that they are part of the current state apparatus with its monopolistic powers. Once this monopoly was dissolved, these stars of politics would become non-entities, because in real life they are mostly nothings, hacks and half-wits, and only democracy allows them to rise to these elevated positions. Left to their own devices, left to their own personal achievements, they are, without almost no exception, complete nobodies. Put bluntly, once the democratic government Congress has declared that from now on everyone would be free to choose his own judge and protector, such that he still can but no longer must choose the government for protection, who in his right mind would ever choose them? That is, the current members of Congress and the federal government, who would choose them voluntarily as their judge and protector. To raise this question is to answer it. Kings and princes possessed real authority. There was coercion involved, no question whatsoever, but they received a significant amount of voluntary support. I mean, I've always sort of considered that, you know, it's really only tyrants that have to wield real power. You know, people that are doing maybe not necessarily unpopular things in a certain sense, but you know, when they receive no gratitude because they aren't great in some sort of sense, there is no sense of a sort of combined spirit within society, if that makes any sense. And that as you engage in sort of democratic nonsense and it all becomes very shallow, you lose the actual connection that was there before. I mean, the king could only be the king if he could demonstrate himself as sort of acting with a oneness and the spirit of what the people wanted in some sense. And that that's a lot more fair to call popular sovereignty than just, you know, using the fact that you've been elected and you hold a position in the state as a justification for why you should do what you do, as opposed to what you do speaking for what you should do. It's a bit tautologist, but it becomes a very sort of succinct point when you think about it in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I'm nothing to add to that. It's just
in contrast, democratic politicians are generally held in contempt, even by their own mob constituency. But there's also no one else to whom one might turn for protection. Local and regional politicians are basically posing the same sort of problem, and with the abolition of their monopoly powers, they obviously do not offer an attractive alternative to this problem either. Nor are there any great entrepreneurial personalities standing in the wings, and insurance companies in particular have become almost entirely creatures of the egalitarian democratic state, and thus appear as little trustworthy as anybody else to take over the particularly important task of protection and justice. Thus, if one did today what the king could have done 100 years ago, there would be the immediate danger of having, in fact, social chaos, or of anarchy in the bad sense. People would indeed at least temporarily become highly vulnerable and defenceless. So then the question becomes, is there no way out? Let me sum up the answer in advance. Yes. But rather than by means of the top-down reform, one's strategy must now be that of a bottom-up revolution. And instead of one battle on a single front, a liberal libertarian revolution will now have to involve many battles on many fronts. That is, we want guerrilla warfare rather than conventional warfare. Which is, I don't know, that the thinking about that now almost sort of smacks a little bit of reading Schmitt and understanding, you know, Carl Schmitt's conception of the constitutional state dictated a kind of top politics that bred what he referred to as partisanship, and that sort of military partisanship was the thing that he saw as breeding a sort of revolutionary spirit. And he talks about how this goes from, you know, Lenin through into Stalin and Mao, and how they all approached combat and using the political mechanisms for combating your enemies in ever more sort of totalizing ways, in ever more sort of consequently brutal ways. And that when you begin to realize that you're no longer fighting for the regime that currently exists, you're actually demanding that society be completely flipped 180 from where it has now arrived. That you are now one of these sort of revolutionary partisan characters. You're not, you know, you're not some noble person from within the system who's looking to fix it, because you're from such a radical position that that notion is just nonsense.
Yeah, I have nothing. I mean, again, you're saying things that I 100% agree with, and so I have nothing to add to.
Fair enough. Before explaining this answer as another step in the direction of this goal, a second sociological fact has to be recognised: the change of the role of intellectuals, of education, and of ideology. As soon as the protection agency becomes a territorial monopolist, that is, a state, it is turned from a genuine protector into a protection racket. And in light of resistance on the part of the victims of this protection racket, a state is in need of legitimacy, of intellectual justification for what it does. The more the state turns from a protector to a protection racket, that is, with every additional increase in taxes and regulation, the greater does the need for legitimacy become. I mean, you can see this directly in something like, you know, you even look at like the Google Ngram results for humanitarianism. And we, you know, if you read Hopper's The Quest for a Grand Narrative, he makes it very clear that violence is a problem that we have got less effective at solving in society. You know, as he discusses here, we have become, or the state has allowed us to become worse at producing justice for a greater sort of cost. And in doing so, it has to justify itself by ever more sort of humanitarian and empathetic kind of causes.
Yeah. I was reading, I want to say it was Curtis Yarvin's on Carlyle, blog post. And he mentioned how apparently in the time of the Sherlock Holmes books, it basically got with a crime. And they could have done it then. We look at England now, and it's like, what happened? You know, it wasn't doable. What changed? If more technology, you think it'd even be easier. And it points back to what I was saying earlier. It's like the state doesn't, like, it's in the state's own interest not to actually solve any problems. it's in the structure to not solve problems, grow on power.
Yeah, I mean, it really starts to then bear down on this point of, you know, the beast itself not being reformable, which is a point I tried to get to so many people, even outside of a libertarian framing, even to people who are conservatives or ethno-nationalists or neo-reactionary or whatever sort of branch of right wing that makes you not in Con Inc. That if you exist out in that space, the thing that separates you from the Con Inc types is that you're a revolutionary and you stand for something that doesn't currently exist. And it is your job to bring that in, not to fix what's here. In a certain sense, you have to put the blinders on. And even though a lot of the things that are still used to legitimize the state now are still supposedly the liberal roots from which Hopper gets his stuff, you have to look to the wayside. Well, we maybe destroy that because maybe that needs to go in the process so that we can really, build something new, not just re-reform, you know, 19th-century liberalism into the same thing and have the same problems a century down the line.
Yeah. No, that's me. What was his name? 2-Bit J. I had him on my podcast. We talked about doing a book club. He was on Suicide West, and his whole point is that once you start off from a liberal framework, it's only a matter of time before it ends up one way. The code is written. You're gonna get 1 point because it's how it's set up to go. It's just a matter of how many things get in the way before you end up in the same spot. You have to remove yourself from the liberal frame completely in order to build something that's going to not result in the same situation.
Oh no, so there is a sort of like there needs to someone needs to come up with it. I don't know if it's maybe something you would maybe get from Spengler or Burnham or but like an anti liberal sort of deterministic theory of the state that you can clearly draw a line from one point to another and that the liberal state must necessarily continue through this process. I mean, I think that's maybe best attempted in something like de Jouvenel's work, where he talks about the systems of the bottom, middle, and the top of society and subsidiary sort of institutions as existing alongside the state. But as soon as a state needs some larger garner of power, or it no longer wishes to compete with some subsidiary institution, it makes use of the bottom of society to attack some middle element so that the top element can gain the power from the middle and leave the bottom as they were before, but just tell them they're better. There's a nice point here as well, which I can't believe I still have to explain to people sometimes, but from the point of view of classical liberalism, the entire system of publicly or tax-funded education must go root and branch. And with this conviction, it is obviously impossible for anyone to make a career with these conditions. I will not ever be able to become the president of the university. My views bar me from becoming from making a career like this. Now, this is not to say that education and intellectuals do not play a role in bringing about a libertarian revolution. To the contrary, as I explained before, everything hinges ultimately on the question of whether or not we will succeed in delegitimizing and exposing as an economic and moral perversity democracy and a democratic monopoly of justice and protection. I mean, anyone that I mean, he's talking about intellectuals and the sort of scene of modern state-funded universities that we have now. I don't see why anyone would ever attend them. I mean, I feel such an idiot sometimes for the fact that I went myself. I
No, I
get.
actually just stopped going. But this last year. Yeah, I was going to get. Oh, my goal was I wanted to be an economics professor, and I went out a whole strategy of like how to take back universities, and then I realized this is never going to happen. That's a pipe dream.
It's not just
And
it's a pipe dream, not to spoil your fun, but the very institution that is modern universities is developed with the sole purpose of, delivering justification for state policy on all different sorts of levels and aspects of society. And it is essentially a factory for these justifications. It doesn't do anything else. It doesn't teach people. It just.
yeah. And that's when I decided really to go because I actually wanted to teach people. I was thinking of doing economics and teach people economics, and I realized if I actually want to teach that, that's not going to happen through this avenue. And I'm not really, the whole goal was I wanted to get tenure somewhere because I had all these shitty professors I wanted to make fun of that I couldn't make fun of without getting in trouble. And I did. I had the cops called me at that school. And so I realized, okay, I'm not going to be that stuff in 6 years and, you know, 10 years in silence and get tenure just to make fun of these losers. I'm just going to quit and make fun of these losers outside the system.
This is obviously nothing but an ideological battle, but it would be wrong-headed to assume the official academia will be of any help in this endeavour. On the government dole, educators and intellectuals will tend to be statists. Intellectual ammunition and ideological direction and coordination can only come from outside of established academia, from centres of intellectual resistance, from an intellectual counterculture outside and independent of and in fundamental opposition to the government monopoly of protection, as well of education, such as the Mises Institute. Big up the Mises Institute, as always. Primary source for a worrying amount of information.
Now it is insane how much is on there. I mean, I give him so much money, not just from like donations, but also like buying books, and it's they are the best.
But no, I do like the fact that in this latter portion where he's discussing strategy, there is a constant sort of framing so that you never forget that the core thing you're attacking as the sort of initial stage here is the concept of democracy. You know, it lacks to the detailed explanation of the meaning of this bottom-up revolutionary strategy. For this, let me turn to my earlier remarks about the defensive use of democracy, that is, the use of democratic means for non-democratic, libertarian, pro-private property ends. There are two preliminary insights I've reached here, which we'll get into in a second. But, you know, if you take Hoppe's lesson from Democracy, the God That Failed, which, or one of them at least, which I think can be generalised to something along the lines of, in a sort of ethical sense, in a political theory sense, if your vote actually then is the thing that then causes the next state policy or the next state aggression, your vote is then an act of violence. And if that act of violence is targeted at a group of society through political rhetoric, then you are engaging in some sort of class warfare there. And if that's the way that it's got to be, then you have to consciously act against democracy in a way that understands that that's how it works, and that the popular sovereignty construct that we are told exists is actually just the nexus through which the public is exploited.
Yeah. Okay, I think we'll see a bottom evolution. We'll get into the part where he actually breaks down the strategy.
Well, I think
This is it.
that it becomes quite obvious from this point on, to be honest. I didn't. I'm sorry, my throat's starting to give way a little bit as well. But I would recommend people maybe give this bit a read on their own. I mean, there's some nice stuff in here. You know, and he's talking about the fact that, you know, you will be called a tiny group of freaks at Waco, and people will be wiped off the map, and but that ultimately this is a sort of a grander struggle, and that once you begin to, you know, as he's trying to say here, grasp this isn't just coming up with some government policy or some sort of economics plan. It is about reformulating society from top to bottom so that it represents and reinforces the values that develop an elite class that have a low time preference and can ultimately try and inculcate some of that kind of preference within the populace as well. Which is a notion that's discussed along a lot, I think, of the internet just now, as this sort of this concept that we need renegade elites, as it were, people who can actually appeal to, you know, as you talked about Carlyle before, some sort of worthy sense of greatness that we can revere and use as a model to show other people what they should head towards, as opposed to just assuming that people through their credentials as some sort of cog and wheel in the state, they have any, there's any reason to listen to those people or that they're worth any value to us.
No, absolutely. Sorry, I'm exhausted.
That's okay. I think, I don't know, There, I could we could sit and read through this for another bit longer, but as I've said, my voice is starting to give way a little bit.
Yeah.
so I think we could possibly kind of close it off there, and I would just recommend that people, I should probably stop scrolling through this, that people go and sort of give this an essay a look, and while they look through it, they should consider that, there is something slightly deeper here than just, oh, my capitalism and freedom. I mean, the entirety of what Hoppe is saying is that there must be an appropriate order in society before it can produce what we then recognise as freedom, as prosperity.
Absolutely, that is that's actually where I get most of from Hoppe. Is like that's actually where I get most of Hoppe. Like it can't just be destruction and the state. It has to be replacement. It has to be new elites. It has to be growth. It can't just be existing outside of it like an agorist, and it can't just be tearing it down like a radical. You have to have built something and work with, you have to somewhat work within the system if you want to actually survive or move forward.
I don't think it's necessary you've got to work within the system, but you've got to understand how the system works to
Yeah,
describe it correctly.
I phrased that poorly. I meant as in becoming elites that are, how to put it, elites that the populace will know about. That's like, and that's what I mean by the system. Like, it's elites that the populace can know and look to, in some sense. Sorry, coming down something, I think.
He's got the cuff, oh no.
Oh no. Second time, let's go. Round two.
Poor show.
Well, it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for coming on. It's been nice to. I don't know. I need to come across more people who are willing to come on. I suppose it's a bit of an awkward time because it's like a Monday at like 7 p.m. and everyone else is like eating their dinner or
Well,
is
it's for me.
busy.
For me, it was 2 o'clock. Like it was two. I was getting ready to take a nap because I was exhausted because I stayed up all night last night doing a podcast. And so I'm about to hop into my bed and take a nap. And I check my phone. And I think I see a text, and I'm like, "Oh, shit, what time is 7 p.m. UK time in Florida now?" And so I'm, yeah, but it's been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed it.
Right, well, I will do my quick duties and show Apostolic Majesty's stream and chat for those who have followed on from the deepest lore, the cabal, or not the cabal, the secret decentralized network of people who are not organizing. Shall prevail. And once again, I will thank everyone for showing up and people that subscribe and are members of the channel and whatever else. And I hope to see you all probably next Monday. I think that'll probably be when the next stream or anything like that is, unless me and Scrump pre-record something for this week, but I honestly don't see it happening. So anyway, goodbye.